explaining.
Good morning, everyone. The meeting will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. We have the minutes of the last meeting before us. Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Any corrections, additions, changes to the minutes of February 6th? See none. All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, just one or two quick item of business. We do still have a whole bunch of budget books up at Gene's desk outside my office, 453, if you're interested in the hard copies. And just a reminder that we have a Ways and Means meeting this Wednesday at 3 o'clock to take up three bills, including the wetland replacement bill. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that, and one of them was what we thought was the vehicle bill for bonding. Is that going to the floor then from here that day?
It will, well, yes. Pretty much everything that we have in here goes to the floor. So, yeah, the plan would be for that bill to go to the floor, to the general register. Yep. Other questions? All right. We have a big agenda today with both systems coming in to testify about higher education. We're going to start out with the University of Minnesota, thinking that we might have a little bit less time with them and just more time with the Minnesota State system, since there are more campuses and so forth with Minnesota State. But starting with the University of Minnesota first, welcome to the committee. Welcome to Minnesota, Brian. Can you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and members of the House Ways and Means Committee. My name is Brian Burnett, and I'm the Senior Vice President for Finance and Operations at the University of Minnesota, and very happy to have joined the system in the last 3 months. So happy to be here. And with me today, Julie.
Good morning. I'm Julie Tonneson. I'm the Associate Vice President for Budget and Finance, and the Budget Director is my title at the University of Minnesota.
And Mr. Burnett, if I can ask you first, how long was Dick Fitzenreiter in your job previous to you? Do you know offhand?
I think Julie knows as well. I think it was about 25 years, 20 to 25 years.
Mr. Chair, members, he started in October of 1992 and just retired June 30th of 2016. So
okay. Because he was the only individual in that position that I ever remembered. So I figured I should ask. Representative Carlson, I'm sure you have a memory of
Mr.
someone
Chairman,
earlier.
Maybe for those that didn't know Mr. Fitzenreiter, but he first went to work for the Minnesota House of Representatives as a fiscal analyst, and one of his committee assignments at that point in time was transportation, and then he ultimately became the chief fiscal analyst over a period of years, and then, of course, went to the University of Minnesota. So he was house trained.
So, Mr. Burnett, see how fortunate you are to have skipped that part of your career path.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, he's been very gracious in the transition and assisting me understanding the Minnesota political system and the legislative history. I did start my career in the House and Senate budget staff in Colorado about 30 years ago. So I have a similar background, but just in a different state. And I'm very happy to be here in Minnesota and serving this great university. So thank you very much for your warm welcome.
Well, thank you. Why don't you go ahead with your presentation? And I guess if we'll see how it goes. If people have questions as you go along, just please raise your hands. If it's bogging us down too much, we'll just stop that and let you go to the end. But for now, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have a fairly brief agenda today, but the agenda was built by input from this committee about requested information about our enrollment changes. Dual credit students, we'll cover that. A little bit about the composite financial index of our campuses that are part of the university system and our appropriations over the last decade. Lastly, we'll talk about performance measures and how the University of Minnesota has done in those performance measures, as well as our biennial budget request before you. So we have just 10 or 12 slides to walk you through very quickly. Since Julie has about 22 years of experience on me, she's going to cover a great deal of this. But I would just say as we get started, obviously, from my perspective, the University of Minnesota is a tremendous asset to the people of the state of Minnesota and the nation. We look at being both the research university and the land grant, and the work we do both here in the Twin Cities, but in our satellite system campuses in Duluth and Crookston and Morris and Rochester, and the extension services we provide to the state's agricultural and outreach communities. It's a very important system, and it's one that Obviously, this state has cared a great deal about over the period to have it where it is today, to have this university sitting where it is today in terms of its rankings, in terms of its ability to produce research and competitive research awards coming into the state of Minnesota. It's something that you should be very proud of where the University of Minnesota is today. With that, we'd like to walk through the agenda fairly quickly and just talk about our headcount and enrollment numbers. And this is over the last 10 years. You can see that we've actually grown in students by about 4%. And it varies, but mainly it's driven by the growth of our undergraduate population. We've added the Rochester campus during this time, which is a tremendous asset in helping the Mayo Clinic with its workforce needs in a small way down in Rochester. But we've also stayed steady in graduate and professional headcount. The non-degree fluctuates based on the types of students that are in our system, some post-secondary options, some of that. We have a lot of different types of students that are in the non-degree headcount. But overall, our enrollment is positive and very steady, and we see it on the upswing as well.
And Mr. Chair, members, we were also asked to provide that information by campus, which is in a separate handout because that information over 10 years was too much to put on a slide. So we do have that information for you by campus in a separate Excel one-page handout. Then we were asked to provide, secondly, information on our dual credit programs for high school students. We have the post-secondary enrollment options program, which, as you may be aware, is a program in which high school students register for and then attend classes on campus. The state pays us this year $198.60 per credit. The range, actually, for resident undergraduates on the campuses is currently $392 to $483. So there is a difference in price there. The second program, College in the Schools, is a program in which teachers are trained by the university to deliver college-level courses for credit to students in their high schools. The state pays school districts some amount for this program, and then the different campuses set a price with the districts on what they will pay. The Twin Cities, each of them has a different rate, actually, but the campuses are compensated on a per registration or a per course basis. The enrollment in these programs has been strong, and on this chart you can see that for PSEL, I'm not sure what happened in the fall of 2008. I don't remember why that number was so high. But in the most recent years, it has been in the 600 to 700 range for PSEO students. College in the Schools has grown consistently from just over 5,000 10 years ago to over 10,000 this last fall. So that's been an extremely popular program.
And Ms. Tonneson, if I can ask a question on that. Now, I assume that these are actual headcounts, not fiscal year equivalents or student full year equivalents.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's accurate. These are fall headcount numbers, actually the end of term headcount numbers in all cases.
Okay, and would it be, and these numbers are included in the total enrollment numbers you gave us in the chart earlier, correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct.
So would it be fair to say that all of the growth that the university's had in the last 10 years has been as a result of, let's say, the CIS program?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, members. These non-degree headcounts on that you see on this chart, on chart 3, where it says non-degree headcount this fiscal year is 5,893, that does not include the College in the Schools numbers, okay, because that is 10,119. So those College in the Schools headcounts are not included in this enrollment on this page.
Okay, even in the far right total headcount or FYE student numbers?
That's correct. They are not included.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, just following up on that. So it appears in the 11-12 years, Duluth started going down and has been going down since then, and in the 14-15, both Morris and Rochester, seemed to drop significantly by 15-16. What's the response when you see those campus-specific numbers, or do you have explanations?
Sure.
Ms. Donaldson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, The response is different depending on the reason for the drop, but in all cases when there is a drop, the campus, we work with the campuses to determine as best we can what's driving that drop and what strategies we can use to turn it around. So in some cases it is the economy, some cases it is demand for programming. So we have attacked, so if you mentioned Duluth, for example, we've been working with the campus there to do two things, really focus on recruitment, which up until that time they did not put a lot of resources into. So we have been working with them on that, as well as retention, because we also see retention numbers drive enrollment. And if we're losing students because of the economy or because they're transferring out of the state or whatever, we have also been working with them specifically on that. So it just depends. Rochester, being a small, very, very small campus, is still trying to find its niche, and so they have had some swings up and down as they're trying to arrive at their totals, and their most recent information is on a big upswing again. So it just really varies by the situation.
Representative Houseman?
Mr. Chair, if I could just clarify that last one, because it looks like Rochester in 15-16 had a dramatic drop. So where do you say the swing?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, members, this year, 16-17, the current year they're back up, and their applications for next year are up as well.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sitting here troubled by the PSEO numbers. They seem to be on a decline. And the actual number surprises me because it's so low. We have this huge system and so few participants. Take a school like Morris. How do we find out how many of PSEO students go to Morris? Is it in here?
Ms. Donison.
Mr. Chair, members, no, we did not provide the detailed information by campus for PSEO and CIS, but we do have those numbers, and we could provide that for you. I do have, for Morris, for example, the numbers are very small. They have, for PSEO, fall of 2016, there's 40 students. It has ranged anywhere from as high as 83 in the fall of 2012, but it's been in that 40 to 83 range. Mr. Chair, members, I'm not an expert on why those numbers would vary. We'd have to talk to the program people who work closely with the schools on that to find out what has been driving some of that decrease, especially from that earlier year of 2008. I would say in the last, 5 to 7 years, it has been relatively steady, but in that 600 to 700 range, but prior to that was significantly more.
Okay, if you could provide us the information by
sure.
campus, if you've got that. Representative Wagenius?
Yeah, I think that it would be helpful. I mean, there is a decline even over the last 5 years. I mean, if you look at that on a chart, the raw number is surprisingly low. So I want to understand how you let people, students, know that this is an opportunity, particularly if you live close to Morris or live in Duluth. This is a tremendous opportunity for kids, and why are so few taking part in this opportunity? It's very curious to me.
Ms. Tonneson?
Again, Mr. Chair, members, we can ask some people for information on that and get back to you and provide a narrative response to that. I don't feel that I know today why that's been happening. It's not something we have discussed recently, but we can find out for you.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman,
yes, Burnett.
Also, the CIS program has doubled over that same period of time, so we knew, we'll get you the answer, but it's possible there's been some substitution of moving towards the CIS. So if you look overall, the numbers are up. They look to me to be doubled over the period of time when you add together the college and the school enrollments with PSEO. So we'll get those answers for you.
Representative Wiggins.
Taken together, the numbers are still small. It's an opportunity for kids. It's a tremendous opportunity. Mm-hmm. So even taken together, it seems like a very small portion of our student population is taking advantage of this. And so my question is, why is that happening?
Okay. Please proceed. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, follow-up to the discussion that we're just having, I got three areas that I wanted to comment on, and then either of the testifiers could respond. But when you were talking about some of the decline, you didn't mention the word cost. And one of the things that's happened in recent years is that the University of Minnesota has become a high-cost system. And, you know, we read about that a lot when we talk about student debt. So I'd like you to comment on that in a moment. When Morris, as I mentioned, I have some history with Morris because I had some family members that attended there. And one of the issues was retention due to transfer because of the professional schools being available on the Twin Cities school or campus. Some students would leave Morris at the end of their sophomore year and transfer into the Twin Cities campus if they were interested in, I don't know, pre-law or engineering or whatever it might be, that just because it is a smaller liberal arts college. So that was an issue we talked about in years past. And then I did have some conversation with representatives of the university a while back. Goes back to President Hussmann, quite frankly, about the drop in students coming from foreign countries. And as the United States became more high cost, they were opting often for other, interesting enough, with one in major exception, English-speaking countries like Canada, Australia, Great Britain, because the cost of attendance was less in those English-speaking countries. And then the other interesting thing was, when I said with one exception, when you talk about Taiwan, which quite a number apparently came from Taiwan over the years, they started to attend college on the mainland China. And that may have been due to the language issue or similarity or cost. I'm not sure why they were beginning to. I thought that was rather interesting because we hear sometimes about the tension between the two. But if you want to respond to those points, especially perhaps the cost issue.
Mr. Burnett, and then once you're finished with your answer and Representative Carlson's, then I'm going to recognize Representative Fabian, and then we're going to go on and have you finish the rest of the presentation, and then we'll take questions. Mr. Burnett.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Carlson, we'll get you the numbers on international students, but I think they've been fairly steady, June.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, and I recall those conversations, and if I'm remembering correctly, it was focused more on the graduate level enrollments, which we have seen reductions in, and there's more arguments to be made about those students going elsewhere in the world, including their own campuses. We actually have had increased applications in recent years on the undergraduate side from international students. That has been growing. So I haven't heard as much there about competition from other schools related to undergraduate education. In terms of the high cost, we recognize, at least for the system campuses, for Crookston, Morris, Duluth, Rochester, that the price point is a competitive factor for them. And so one of the things we have done as their enrollment has softened, particularly at Duluth in the last few years, is we have worked very hard with the state's help to hold the tuition rates flat. And actually are planning that into the future as much as possible so that they are not further disadvantaged in that. But it is the case. We also have increased our financial aid, particularly related to need-based financial aid for low- and middle-income families. So we have put more money into that program, again, to try to address some of those reasons why students are not attending or why enrollment is softening in some cases. So that is one of the factors that we have heard about. In terms of the transfer for Morris students, I can't speak specifically to how many how much of their retention problem is due to retention transfer issues within the system itself. I will tell you that they have been working with some of our professional programs to build pipelines so that it is a set pipeline from Morris, for example, to go into nursing. It has been a recent one, and I believe they're talking to some of the other professions about that as well. That is a designed program so that when students actually enter as freshmen, they see the path and understand how after 3 or 4 years they will get to that professional program in the Twin Cities. But other than that, I'm not aware of that being any more of a retention problem than the just general people are leaving for their personal reasons or economic reasons.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be brief. To Representative Wagenius's comments about the PSEO and possible reasons for decline, in the 35 years that I was teaching in Roseville, when the PSEO program came in, kind of late in my career, I'll say, when you stop to think about taking a 16 or 17-year-old student out of their home environment and then sending them off from Roseville down to University of Minnesota at Crookston or down here or to Morehead State or wherever, Minnesota State and Mankato, name it, that's a big commitment for a family to make. And to thrust a 16-year-old into that environment. Now, if you live in Dilworth, Representative Marquardt, it's probably a little bit easier because you can live at home and you can commute back and forth, and, and it's not as much of a, I'll say, a social adjustment. So there's a lot of factors involved in that, but we're also seeing here, too, then, that the college in the classroom, or college in the school's enrollment is increasing, mm-hmm. and I think that there is a tremendous appetite for those classes being made available to help with the burden after a student graduates with regards to the tuition credits and so forth. But I do want to make a comment, and Representative Loon, I'm sure, can address this probably better than I can. It's becoming more and more difficult for a lot of our small rural schools to be able to offer the college and the schools programs because of the requirements that are placed on the districts for what the instructor needs to have available as their credentials, I'll say, and the heightening of those is causing a lot of problems in a lot of our small rural schools. It would be beneficial if we could somehow work with the accrediting agencies and so forth to relax some of those and still require, I mean, you have to do your course outline and so forth, and you have to meet certain standards in that. But as is the case in so many different areas in education in rural Minnesota, it's more and more difficult just to find staff, period, let alone staff that's qualified to teach the college and the schools program. So anything that you could do working with our K-12 Education Finance Committee would be very much appreciated. So just a comment, Mr. Chair. I wasn't asking a question. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Mr. Burnett, please proceed. Let's go to the slide talking about the composite financial index.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. One of the other data elements that the committee asked us to prepare was the composite financial index. And what that is it's a series of scores, five data points that you look at with respect to the balance sheet, candidly, of the and the income statement, really, of any institution. And what we're showing you is really two ways to look at our composite financial index. The Twin Cities campus is very strong at 4.37, but we did have GASB is the Government Accounting Standards Board, and a few years ago that board made it mandatory for all schools across the country to show their net pension liability on their balance sheet. So that eroded nearly everyone's who has a defined benefit piece to their retirement. And you can see really the number that is probably most appropriate is out to the right, the second column, that it's still around 4 for the Twin Cities campus, 2.83 for Morris, almost 4 for Duluth, and 3.3 for Crookston. That's not unsurprising for small campuses in systems like the University of Minnesota. They don't have the scale that the Duluth and the Twin Cities campus have. But I would remind members of the committee that the University of Minnesota is one body corporate. So we work together with those campuses. The financial strength of the Twin Cities assists all the campuses in terms of their borrowing costs, those types of things, the procurement that we do together, the sharing of costs that we do together. So while those numbers can look a little bit alarming or just as not as ideal as possible, you have to remember that these campuses are part and parcel of an entire one-body corporate of the University of Minnesota. So we don't see any alarm bells there or anything to be concerned about at this point.
Mr. Chair, members, we were then also asked to provide a history of our state appropriations. So what you see here is 10 years from 2008 through 2017. And for this purpose, we've included all of our operating appropriations, which essentially excludes the one-time project-type appropriations through the LCCMR, or sometimes we get special grants or transfers from state agencies on a one-time basis to do projects. Those are not included here. During this time, the appropriation has dropped $58 million, or 8.2%, unadjusted for inflation. If you adjust for the CPI, then that $708.8 in 2008 would be equivalent to $790.1 in 2016. So our $650 million is about $140 million short in terms of that buying power from 2008. Moving to then an update on our performance measures for the current biennium. Earlier this year, the university provided the state of Minnesota with our final results on achieving the measures identified in the laws of 2015, which were focused on graduation rates for students of color and for undergraduates, the number of STEM degrees awarded, and internal reallocation of administrative costs and invention disclosures. The law made 5% of the FY17 O&M appropriation, or $28 million, contingent on the university meeting 3 out of these 5 performance goals. So we would get 100% of the contingent amount would be released if we met at least 3, 67% would be released if 2 goals were met, 33% for 1, and 0 if none of them were met. All the goals were met, as indicated on this chart, so the full 5% of the appropriation has now been released to us.
The next piece that you asked us to cover in this presentation today was to briefly go over our legislative budget request for the upcoming biennium. It really is broken into about 6 distinct parts, and we list the core mission first. This is where we do our instruction, our instruction of our students across our 5 campuses, and clearly the combination of tuition and state support is what provides the money to be able to educate our students. And the reason we see a core mission being very important, a core mission increase in our appropriation, is the need to provide our employees with a salary increase over the next biennium. We think that 2%, given where CPI is and that type of thing, we're currently modeling a 2% pool. But we think that our employees deserve a compensation increase for the great work that they do every day. Second is student success. As we talked earlier, improving our retention, our graduation rates, access to the more expensive and high-demand STEM disciplines. We brought some investments forth in the budget request for the student success piece of our request. The next piece, MnDrive, is really about the research piece of the university, and it's been very successful. Tremendous return for the state on the MnDrive money already appropriated, and we're very grateful for the support from the Minnesota legislature towards that. And we see that growing and being able to bring in additional clusters of excellence that help drive our economic development value to the state of Minnesota. Next, the NRRI, the Applied Research for Economic Development. This is a unique program about strategic programs in 3 areas, minerals, mining, and water, energy and the environment, and then forest products and the bioeconomy. Those are all big issues for Minnesota, particularly outstate Minnesota, as we think about economic vitality of our state. And then health training restoration. We faced a multi-million-dollar gap with changes that have happened on the landscape with respect to Medicaid and the provider UCARE not having its contract with the state. And those have created multi-million-dollar gaps in our Department of Family Medicine within our medical school. Brooks Jackson, our Vice President and Dean of the Medical School, has testified previously, and it just came out that the University of Minnesota's medical school is the number one provider of general practitioners in the United States of any medical school. And we are about 70% of all the doctors practicing in the state of Minnesota were trained by the Department of Family Medicine. So it's a huge pride point and a huge need for the medical services of citizens of Minnesota that we have the ability to train the next generation of general practitioners. And finally, the last one, the Bell Museum, that is under construction and scheduled to be complete next summer on the St. Paul campus. We believe that that program was built to expand teaching opportunities and learning opportunities for K-12 students, particularly that can visit the planetarium and other pieces that are vital in the new Bell Museum. And we're very grateful for the state legislature's support of the Bell Museum's new location on St. Paul.
And in terms of the numbers related to the request, they are displayed in this chart in two different ways. So the box on the left represents the annual incremental changes year to year. So the 2018 column, for example, is $48.6 million over our FY17 level, and then we're asking for an additional $50 million for FY19 over FY18. Those are 7.8% and a 7.4% annual increases, respectively. The chart on the right is the biennial math. So it is the first year times 2 plus the incremental increase in the second year. And in that math, we're asking for an 11.8% increase or $147.2 million. We have just separated each of them with the dark bar in the middle to represent things that are new needs for the next biennium. And then underneath that, kind of unfinished business that are new need, that are have a need in the next biennium, but they are things that we have spoken about in the past. So they are not new issues for the university or the legislature. And with that, Mr. Chair, we stand.
Those were what we were asked to prepare for today and a brief presentation. We're happy to take questions in the time that you'd like us to.
Okay, I've got Representative Fabian, Pawlowski, and Dean. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is for either of the testifiers. You said in on your second to the last slide, the 2% increase for employees, does that define 2% for me and what it includes?
Mr. Burnett?
I'm going to have Julie Austin put that budget model together before I arrive, so I'm going to have her give you an accurate answer. How about that?
Mr. Chair, members, that would be a general pool, general budget assumption of a 2% salary increase plus the associated fringe benefit costs on top of that. Any steps increases would be within the 2%. So it isn't 2% plus steps. It's a hard 2% a planning assumption for all employees.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so then what are you calculating for the rest of the benefit package, which would include retirement and health care and so forth?
Mr. Chair, members, our benefits actually, we operate, it's kind of a complicated system that has to be approved by the federal government every year because the rates are charged to grants. So what we are actually planning for costs in FY18 represents actual costs in FY16. And we collect those costs through a fringe benefit rate. We are not projecting or planning any increased benefits, the actual provision of benefits. It's simply an increased cost to our university departments to pay for the benefits that relate again to FY16. I don't know if that answers your question, but there's no planned increase in retirement benefits or health benefits for our employees.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then further down on that same slide, you talked about 70% of the GPs graduating from medical school. Where do those people go when they graduate from the U? What percentage of those folks stay here in Minnesota?
Mr. Burnett?
Mr. Chairman, we can get, sir, we'll get that information for you, but we've got a pretty good list across the state of the alums that are our docs and where they go. I think it varies with each class, but I think in the last analysis done, when they looked at all the general practitioners across the state of Minnesota, 70% were ours. So we would anticipate, Dr. Jackson, I think, believes that at least 7 out of 10 of our next set of graduates like living and practicing in Minnesota, and we would not expect much change there.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, part of the reason why I ask this is because in my time here in the legislature, I've had high school students from Northwest Minnesota mm-hmm. who've met all the entrance requirements to attend different professional schools at the U, have gotten their undergraduate work in Minnesota at some of the university campuses and some of the Minsky campuses, and they have been rejected for enrollment. And quite frankly, I'm very disappointed by that. I've told this to the U three or four times. I've been told that the university has a very strong commitment to bringing in people from all over the country. And quite frankly, I believe that if someone from the state of Minnesota meets the entrance requirements, they should be allowed admittance into the University of Minnesota in place of people from out of state. And my question for you again this year is, what is the university doing to address that very, very serious concern?
Mr. Burnett?
Mr. Chairman, we'll get some information back to you about that. I believe we have many more qualified applicants than we have available slots in our medical school or our dental school, but we'll get you that data. But your point is well taken. I would tell you that one of the big projects that is on the slate and has been talked about here with this body is the Health Sciences Education Center, and we have proposed that if that building got funded, we would have more capacity to take additional qualified medical students. But right now, we have constraints with respect to space in many of the spaces that date back to the 20s where we're doing the education of the doctors of tomorrow. So part of it's a capital piece. Part of it we'd have to add faculty to add to that as well. But we do have some capital and some building constraints. But we'll get you the data, sir, on how many qualified applicants we are not able to accept just because we have so many applicants for these coveted slots.
Last question, Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Do you have quotas in your schools for in-state and out-of-state students?
Mr. Burnett?
We'll have to get back to you on what those numbers look like, sir. I don't know those off the top of my head, and I wouldn't speculate here. But we'll get you those answers. Those are fair questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know you're trying to hurry this along, but this is something that's really important to my constituents because we've been on the short end of the stick too many times. And if those numbers don't change and the percentages don't change, I'm led to believe, quite frankly, that internally there may not be any documentation about quotas, but organizationally there is, and that's very disturbing to me. And, Mr. Chair, may I? One more?
One more.
Thank you, sir.
I'm hurrying along.
I know you're trying to hurry this along, and I appreciate that. Mr. Burnett, there's been a lot of things that happened at the U with regards to football and so forth, and I don't want to rehash all of that. But I'm reading an article here from the Star Tribune, and it says that the U is going to loan the athletic department $5.6 million from Central Reserves to cover the buyouts of former staff. What is the mechanism for doing that, and how much money is actually in the Central Reserves?
Mr. Burnett?
Mr. Chairman, sir, we have about $20 million that is part of the Central Reserves that are managed and actually reported to the board at least annually, if not more often than that. And that will take specific board action, which will happen later this fiscal year as we get the final costs of the transition. We believe that the athletic department gave information to the board last week can pay that loan back over a two-year period. And it's not the first loan that's been advanced to athletics, and it's in a university that's got as many moving parts as the University of Minnesota. Loans are made to academic units, loans are made to clinical units, loans are made in different ways for strategic purposes. So I would share with you that we expect that to be paid back. We believe that the athletic department will have the revenue to pay that back, and it's part of making a strategic move at the head coaching position for our football program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pawlowski, Dean, and Liebling. Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first question I have is, can you explain the consequences of not getting your budget requests in 2015 and 2016? Can you articulate for me how this presentation is somehow linked to not getting those budget requests of 15 and 16?
Mr. Burnett.
Mr. Chairman, if I can, I'd like to defer to Julie, who was here and understands what the consequences were before I arrived at the university.
Hey, Ms. Donison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, I'm trying to remember. I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly what the requests were at that time, but I imagine it was a combination of things that we didn't do sometimes when we ask for something for MnDrive, for example, when we're proposing a new program, if we don't get the funding, then we don't do that. And so it doesn't have an impact on the base operating budget. So that would be a piece of it. In addition to that, we did not in 15 and 16. So if it was FY16 and FY17, we did end up raising tuition this year, which is FY17, and a lesser amount in FY16 because some of that request was not funded. So we did raise tuition. We also internally reallocated more than we otherwise would have, which means we make cuts inside the university to pay for cost increases that are either unavoidable in the case of facilities or that were a high priority. So those are really our tools we have. We can internally reallocate. We can choose to not do something, not do a new thing, and or we look to tuition. That we have increased also on a regular basis the non-resident tuition rate on the Twin Cities campus more significantly than the resident rate over really the last 5 or 6 years. So that is another tool.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, thank you at least for the recognition of the tuition increase. My concern is that the higher ed budget seemed to be somewhat episodic. It is, to use a crude phrase, what can you sell the legislators on the Hill this legislative session? And then the next session, it appears to be different. I did see on a slide on page 5, slide 10, that at least you made a nod to keeping a lid on tuition. That doesn't mean you're going to freeze it. It's a lid. I'm not sure what that means, a 1% or 2% increase. So it's unfortunate that we don't have a consistency in your budget presentations. That wasn't what was important last session, apparently isn't that important this session. We're off to something else. And it does appear to be whatever you can sell the legislators this session. Can you go over just very quickly Dayton's budget in comparison to your budget requests? Did the governor fully fund your budget requests? And if not, where?
Mr. Burnett?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pawlowski, so Julie can walk you through the specific numbers, but if you look at the far right of this slide at 147.2, it's my understanding the governor's number was closer to $96 million, so it was about $55 million less than what we asked for over the biennium. And we can walk you through one by one each one, but it was mainly he did not fund as much of the student success. He fully funded our core mission request. Again, back to the salary increases we believe we need to provide for our employees. A piece of the MnDrive. He didn't do all of the MnDrive. He did a little bit of the student success. The health training restoration was fully funded, and he did not recommend funding the Bell Museum. That's my memory.
Mr. Chair, members, that's correct. Core mission 100% was funded. MnDrive, only one piece of that related to the cancer initiative was funded. For a total in the biennial math of $8 million for that one. Core mission was 68.2 in biennial math. Investing in student success, he funded only the equity portions of that for a total of $2.6 million in biennial math. He fully funded the NRRI request at $4 million, and he fully funded the health training restoration request at $14 million. The Bell Museum was zero. So the total from the governor is $96.8 million. Dollars or a 7.7% increase in biennial math.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, thank you. I consider the governor's budget a very generous budget, but even under that generous budget, he doesn't fully fund your requests. So I know that next legislative session, it would be interesting to see if there was a consequence to that. But I'm going to go back to one other slide, 8, legislative performance measures. I asked this question of President Keeler, so I'm going to see if I get the same answer here. Can you tell me when the University of Minnesota has never met a legislative performance measure and therefore lost money?
Ms. Tonneson or Mr. Burnett?
Ms. Tonneson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, we have never lost money from not meeting a performance measure.
Mr. Chair, These legislative performance measures seem to be a gift to the university. No matter how we craft them, they always meet them. If it's 3 out of 5, they'll meet 3 out of 5. I believe it was 4 out of 5, you could have met 4 out of 5. And if it was 5 out of 5, you would have met 5 out of 5. So I do question the validity of having performance measures that you can always meet. These usually are not House side, they're usually Senate side, but I'm not necessarily against investing in higher ed, but this does seem to be somewhat of a con job here when you're always meeting them, and no matter what we set for a target. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Burnett. If I can just respond, Representative Pulaski, the performance measures really have been a recent addition in public policy across the country, and I believe about 35 to 40 states have some measure of performance funding tied to it. Different measures. What I will tell you, I look at it and I understand your concern about everything being achieved. I also think that, especially someone looking at this fresh and coming from another state, that at some point you're going to have to look at a sustained excellence level for these performance measures, because it's arithmetically impossible to keep growing graduation rates above 100% or retention rates. So I think we'll have to look at some external benchmarking, those types of things, future, not now, but down the road, of what is a acceptable range of excellence that you're going to expect for the investment the state makes in the university. Thank you.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, I can appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And yet any time you set a really difficult performance measure, you come back with something else. We had, in 2013, the legislative auditor's language for you to freeze tuition. And do you remember what you told us about that language? It passed the House with bipartisan support. We went in the conference committee. What did you say to that performance measure?
Mr. Chairman, I was...
It was extra-constitutional, and they'd sue us if we kept it in the conference committee report. So I'm all for your performance measures when you say you can meet them, but if we really set a high one, you say, well, you can't tell us what to do, we're extra-constitutional. That's just a statement that doesn't demand an answer.
Before I go to Representative Dean, if I can just do one quick follow-up question. So, Mr. Burnett, what sort of a tuition increase will students have if the university is given their full budget request? And what sort of a tuition increase will students have if they're given the governor's budget request?
Mr. Chairman, it's early, and these depend on the Board of Regents' decisions, obviously, because they're the ones that approve our tuition rates. But the President has said for residents of the state of Minnesota, if we got our full tuition, our full budget request, we would not raise resident rates for the state of Minnesota undergrad.
We would not raise, we would minimize an increase, is what he has said. President Kaler has said we would minimize an increase, which is more than likely in that 1 to 2% range, Mr. Chairman.
So 1 to 2% per year for in-state tuition if you get your request.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, and that's Twin Cities is the current planning. And again, that is dependent and contingent on board discussion and board approval.
Right. And then would it be the same for the governor's request, since the governor is granting in his proposal the full core mission dollars, or is that different?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe it would be the same. We would work hard. The one piece that will give us a challenge is the student success area. Some of that programming is really critical to meeting the needs of students, so we will be working to try to address those needs as well as the core mission within that general parameter of minimizing tuition.
Okay, thank you. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Tennyson, Mr. Burnett. I would just have a question about restoration of health training dollars. Just how much is that, and how does that break out from that piece from slide number 10?
Mr. Chairman? So the health training restoration is $6 million in 2018, and then an incremental $2 million in the second year of the biennium. So it's a total of $14 million incremental. And that really is all going to the Department of Family Medicine.
And Mr. Chair, members, and also some to the mobile dental clinic, because that has also received funding through UCARE.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. For the Obviously, we restored Merck funding in the last budget request and tried to add some dollars within that. How is the university looking at more globally addressing medical training dollars and having it detached or changed from its over-reliance on Merck?
Mr. Burnett or Ms. Thompson?
I defer to Ms. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not sure I can answer that question. I don't have enough knowledge about that. We'll have to get back to you on Merck. I'm just not clear on the Merck funding and how it relates to everything within the medical school, so I don't want to speculate on that. I apologize.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Thompson, the NRRI, Applied Research for Economic Development, what is the history of that, and why is it limited to the areas of minerals, mining, water, and environment?
Ms. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members, the NRRI has, the history is that is an institute on the Duluth campus that has focused and is currently focusing in some of the programmatic areas. That's what they're focusing on. It would not mean that the funding has to be in those areas, but that is what that institute currently is focusing on. They have received a state special for many years, as long as I've been at the university, so more than 20 years. They have received a state special, which has, like all the state specials, has not gone up, but we have been subsidizing, if you will, that institute with other funds, with O&M and tuition dollars. And their goal here is, because there is a large number, really, a body of research at the university in these areas, in environmental and ag and so forth, NRI is uniquely placed in that part of the state to work with research that's happening even on the Twin Cities campus or with other institutions. And so they are being stretched. And so this is really an opportunity for us to recognize what they can contribute broadly throughout the state and provide funding in these areas for them. So that's really what this is about.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. I appreciate that, and we'll follow up on the Merck funding, which we want to try to address a little bit more specifically, I know, in our committee. And just to Representative Fabian's point, I graduated from the U a long time ago, and when my kid was applying to schools, I wanted him to be a Gopher, so he applied. And he also applied to Madison and Ames. And I'll be doggone if they are not Johnny-on-the-spot, stuffed back in the mailboxes immediately, and very interested in the boy going to Wisconsin and Iowa. Not so much from the U. It took a long time for him to figure that out, and luckily was accepted, all of them. But in looking over the last dozen years of my home district in Matamidi, every year they publish where the kids go. Mm-hmm. And every year I see a few less Minnesota and a few more Madison and a few more Ames. And it just seems like a little bit every year. And I talk to other moms and dads, kids with very, very high ACT scores, you know, near above 30, good GPAs, and they just feel like they just don't feel the love from the U. And I know it's competitive, but I agree with Representative Fabian that our kids in Minnesota should want to go to the U, our athletes should want to go to the U, and I feel like we need to compete more for Minnesota kids. And I see that in my neighborhood, in my district, and now in my with my kids. And so I hope that that's there, because I know that we all want to invest in a great University of Minnesota, yeah. And we want it to be good, but we want it to be good for our kids. And so our kids go to medical school here, they go to residency here, and they stick around and go to our little tiny towns that need a doctor. That's what we want. And so I hope we're more competitive than what it looks like we are currently.
Okay, members, I'm going to recognize Representative Liebling, who was on the list before, and then I'm afraid we're going to have to stop and move on to the Minnesota State questions. So if you have other questions, maybe you can catch our testifiers afterwards, or we can submit the questions. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just First of all, I just wanted to mention when Representative Fabian was talking about this problem of acceptance of Minnesota students and training Minnesota doctors that, you know, I agree. I think it's a really a problem. I'd love to see us expand capacity at the U altogether. But I just wanted to note that I know the U does have some programs to really try to get students to go and practice medicine in rural Minnesota, and it'd probably be good to know a little bit more about that. But I know they've been pretty successful in, you know, they've taken that that charge at least pretty seriously. The other thing I just wanted to note, and Representative Dean touched on it, is this business about the health training restoration. And just to point out what that is, and I know Representative Dean is aware, but UCARE was, you know, as UCARE in its role as a provider of Medicaid services for the state, you know, we pay capitated rates to our Medicaid providers, and I know Representative Drazkowski is probably going to be interested in this. In the last session, we tightened down on what they can do with our money and count it back to us. So one of the things we said was, you can't give charitable contributions and then count it against what you tell us our rates need to be. So I believe that's what this is, because UCARE was giving big chunks of money to the U, not a bad cause, but money that we thought we were spending on Medicaid, they were using extra of that to do things that they wanted to do. And our thought was, if we're going to make contributions to things, we want to do it and know what that is, not pass it through kind of through the back door through our Medicaid rates. So I just wanted to kind of point that out for the committee. And if the testifiers think I'm wrong about that, please say so.
Mr. Burnett or Ms. Tonneson?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that is correct. Yes, UCARE was providing in the most recent year $10 million to the university, to these two departments in total.
So is this part of is this part of the core mission sort of the medical school that you need to keep going sort of no matter what, or is this more sort of charity care that you was doing?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it provides funds to help our doctors extend their services and do their training with at-risk populations, so it is part and parcel of their education, but we'll be glad to answer how we use that money. It has a hole right now in the Department of Family Medicine.
Yes,
remember.
Mr. Chair, members, it is to fund, in large part, the residency program in that department.
Right.
They use that funding for that purpose, so it is a core funding need for that department.
Okay, thank you. I didn't mean the phrase charity care to be in any way a bad-sounding phrase. I was just trying to get a sense of how this was related to the department and sort of its core mission.
Yes.
As opposed to how it was related to providing other needed care, but perhaps not necessarily part of the core mission. So thank you very much, Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Chair, can I make a request that the university send what I just received, the reserves of the University of Minnesota? It's broken down by campus and by system. I think the committee would find those reserves most interesting.
Sure, yeah, we could get that. And then one final request from me, too. I noted back on the slide where you talked about the state appropriations, these were sort of unrestricted appropriations going back the last 10 years. If we could get sort of the total appropriations, I know that some of them are carved out, and we've traditionally done less of that, I think, in the House than they have in the Senate. But I'd be interested in knowing that and also in knowing, you know, if we didn't provide as much of the appropriations as have been requested, what the consequence of tuition would be. So with that, thank you very much. Welcome to Minnesota, Mr. Burnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We appreciate your time.
Okay.
Give us a moment, Mr. Chair, to change technology.
Hello, Dr. King.
Just trying to open up this one. Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Dr. King.
My name is Laura King, and I'm the Vice Chancellor for Finance for Minnesota State, and I'm joined by Craig Schoenecker, who's the Director of Research, and at my back, I believe, is Deb Bednarz, who is our Director of Financial Planning and Analysis. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're delighted to be here with you today and with your committee, and thank you for the guidance that you provided me on the topics of interest to your committee. And so I hope to move through them. I have some slides here that may well address many questions that members have, and then certainly we'll have time for questions. We're looking forward to sharing with you today some information about enrollment, an update on the financial profile of our colleges and universities, and a brief overview of our fiscal 18-19 biennial budget request. You will also find at your place a 147-page data book. This book was provided to the Higher Education Committee several weeks ago and to their staff, and we make it available to you as well. And we're always inviting other pieces of information that you'd like us to add to it, and we'd be happy to do that. I know that your committee wants clarity on tuition plans, the relationship between actions this session and the financial condition of our colleges and universities, the impact of labor costs, and campus budget cuts. And I will address all of those in my remarks today. So if members can bear with me, I'm going to try to move through some slides pretty quickly, and you'll also find them at your place. Minnesota State serves the entire state from International Falls to Granite Falls, with 45 communities in between. Our 37 colleges and universities are an integral part of our state's success. The innovation and services that our faculty and staff bring to students and businesses makes an impact today and years into the future. Our continued ability to serve the state is threatened by our financial outlook, and we look forward to sharing with you today and in the days ahead. We serve students across the state. 39% of our students are in the metro area, and 61% are on campuses in greater Minnesota. This distribution has shifted gradually towards the metro area in the last decade or so. 59% of our college students and 37% of our university students enroll part-time, and 46% of our students take one or more online courses. 15% are entirely online, and 7% enroll both on the ground and online in the same term. Who we serve is fundamentally different from other providers of higher education. Of the 254,000 students in degree-seeking programs this past year, 63,000 were students of color or American Indian students, 48,000 were first-generation students, 84,000 were low-income students, and 10,000 were veterans or service members. In each of these categories, our colleges and universities serve more students than all of Minnesota's other higher education providers combined. We are a place of hope and opportunity. With open enrollment, anyone with a high school diploma or GED has an opportunity to create a better future for themselves, for their families, and for their communities. The racial and ethnic diversity of our students brings significant assets to campus life and creates a dynamic community for learning together with one another. 31% of our total credit headcount is represented by students of color and American Indian students, a percentage that has been increasing in recent years. And it's been increasing across the state. The growth in students of color and American Indian students at our colleges and universities has occurred in all regions of Minnesota and has increased by 50% or more in 5 of the 6 regions of Minnesota since 2007. Enrollment grew 17% from the trough in 2006 to the peak in 2011, and it has since declined 16.9% to 131,000 full-time equivalents, or near pre-recession levels. This graphic has always struck me as a powerful image of the role our colleges and universities play in the state's economy. you can lay the state's unemployment graph right on top of this. As the unemployment rate moves, so too does our enrollment levels. As students return to school for additional certifications, to finish degree work, to gain new skills, or to respond to a changing labor market. As the economy improves, students finish their coursework, or sometimes they're recruited away, and they return to the labor force. If we end this session with a tuition freeze, a low target, and typical labor contracts, this enrollment outlook should tell you that we have campuses that are in trouble. You see slightly different trends when examining credit versus non-credit enrollment. Non-credit enrollment is more often paid for by employers, and so it trends with employment levels. You also see different trends when separating college and university credit and looking at them individually. As is apparent here, the enrollment in both credit and non-credit instruction was much more volatile at the colleges than at the universities, which makes sense since college students are more likely older and in or out of the workforce. Universities, though, are also struggling. Just this last week, I was with two universities who have experienced flat or declining enrollment and have an outlook that continues flat or declining for the next 5 years. All of our colleges and universities have student recruitment and retention programs underway. Curriculum is being added and revised, schedules modified, student success activities pursued, and business and industry partnerships developed as we continue to serve our students and communities across the state. I'd like to share with you a slide that illustrates what has happened to higher education funding in Minnesota over the past 20 years. This is not a state of Minnesota slide. This is not a Minnesota state slide, it's a state of Minnesota slide. And it illustrates that Minnesota's investment in public higher education lags the national average, though that was not always the case. In 1995, Minnesota's per FYE funding for public higher education was 5% higher than the national average. 10 years later, in 2005, Minnesota's spending on a per FYE basis, adjusted for inflation, lagged the national average by 9%. And by 2015, the most recent year data is available, we now lag the national average by 14%. Between 1995 and 2015, Minnesota's investment in higher education has declined at twice the national average, from 14% to 29%. And you see that, the consequence of that, in both the remarks you just heard from the university and the remarks you'll hear from us here today. As of 2014, Minnesota spends 25% less than the national average on its 30 community and technical colleges, and 24% less than the national average on the universities. This translates, if we were funded just at the national average levels, that would translate into an additional $184 million that has migrated out of Minnesota's investment in higher education over the last 20 years. And this has shown up as financial pressures on our colleges and universities. Our board, our chancellor, and all of our presidents are committed to the financial health of our colleges and universities. And the board's position, like yours and like the governor's, is that expenses and revenues have to balance. The board will approve budgets this spring when your work is done, and they are committed to approving structurally balanced budgets for all of our colleges and universities. As you can see on the screen, this has been hard to do these past years as compensation cost increases have outpaced our revenue increases. While our revenue growth has averaged about 1.2% a year since 2008, our compensation cost increases have averaged between 4 and 5% a year. Which brings us to the center of our biennial budget request, which is a request for $143 million in additional base support. All of these funds would go to the campuses. None of them stay in the system office, and they would provide sufficient revenues for a presumed 3% increase in total compensation costs and a 3% increase in operating cost items. We talk about this a little differently than the university talks about it. They talked about a 2% salary increase plus whatever fringes that are attached to that. We talk about a 3% total compensation increase, which includes fringes and salary costs. Like what you just heard, though, this is a total cost number. It's not plus for steps and promotions. It would be an expected total increase in salary and fringe costs year over year of 3%. This structure is important to us in that you'll see in our request that we're asking for $48 million in fiscal 18 and $95 million in fiscal 19. It's important to us that that one-third, two-thirds appropriation be provided, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a slide or two. We pay very close attention to what our financial profile looks like compared to other similar systems, and we find that we're in the bottom 10% of systems nationwide when we look at spending across all levels, whether faculty ratios, administrative spending, facilities maintenance, or executive offices. There are certainly things we can do to become even more efficient and effective, and we have those initiatives underway. But the returns are modest in comparison to the challenge we face in our structural outlook. We rank 33rd out of 50 systems in the country in spending on administrative operations. You've seen about a 10% decline in our total number of employees over the last 10 years. The system office budget has dropped from $43 million to $33 million. And institutional spending, which is the support that goes to the campus administrative budgets, has fallen from 12.4% of total expenses to 11.8% of total expenses. So we take those as indications that we have continued to improve efficiency, and yet we remain challenged in our structural outlook. Our outlook worsens significantly if we're not able, through this process, to return to the traditional appropriation provision. And you can see what happened to this one. There you go. You can see on the slide that we entered this biennium with a $20 million structural problem. And it was made worse by the loading of the appropriation in the 16-17 budget bill. The appropriation in 16-17 was provided at $50 million a year, and since our cost increases don't go like that, the deficit at the end of 17 grew to $36 million a year entering into 18. And this, of course, is before the impact of any new salary settlements in the 18-19 biennium. So it is our fervent hope that the legislature is able to restore past practice when you're approaching the biennial budget. Over the past 5 years, as our revenue increases have lagged our expense increases, we have turned to reallocations in a more substantial way. You can see in fiscal 17 that with declining enrollment and flat state support, we had $38 million in reallocations. Our colleges and universities really have a tough hand. Both revenues and expenses are strongly influenced by others and highly unpredictable. Regulatory and compliance costs increase every year, as do the desires for stronger student services and campus life programs. And we reallocate both to invest in those activities and to balance budgets. Over the past 9 years, our colleges and universities have reallocated on average $34 million per year. In just the past 5 years, we've reallocated a total of $180 million, including in 16, $11 million in absolute budget cuts. These cuts have eliminated jobs, closed programs, slowed technology and equipment replacement, and placed tremendous pressure on the campuses. In the data book, you'll find a reallocation table in the financial section, and this shows you action by action where those reallocations occurred in fiscal 16. You see in 16, colleges reallocated a total of $38 million. including 9 suspended or closed programs, 121 eliminated faculty positions, and 155 eliminated staff positions. These reallocations were used in 2 ways. $14 million was reinvested in programs, and $24 million was a simple budget cut. Costs were removed, programs stayed closed, faculty and staff positions did not come back, and technology and equipment budgets were reduced. These reductions were felt on every campus, and you probably heard about them in your travels or read about them in your local newspaper. In your local newspapers, campuses have been working very hard to maintain balanced budgets under very difficult circumstances. Which brings us to our 18-19 budget request, which has 3 important goals. To protect the programs and campuses so that we can meet the workforce needs in communities across Minnesota. To reduce economic and racial disparities by protecting affordability, access, and advancing student success. And to provide the faculty, staff, and IT infrastructure needed to deliver these programs. We came to you 2 years ago and asked for your support in beginning to reverse the trend in the funding relationship, and you gave us that support. Our fiscal 18-19 request seeks to continue that progress in restoration of the state's historic investment in human capital. Our request seeks a compact on behalf of our students, a compact that will enable us to serve them better in ways that will prepare them for work that needs to be done in communities across the state. We understand that it's a large request, but without $178 million in new revenue, the colleges and universities dedicated to meeting the state's workforce needs will have to make substantial cuts in programs and services across the state. That outcome would be bad for students, bad for communities, and bad for Minnesota's future. If fully funded, the board has committed to hold undergraduate tuition rates flat in fiscal 18 and 19. The centerpiece of our request is the $143 million for campus support, and this is just straightforward resources to provide the basic operating budget. Oh, thank you, Bernie. 75% of our costs are labor, and labor negotiations are coming up this spring. We are pledged to delivering a balanced budget to the board, and revenues will need to match expenses. We'll need your help to fund new labor costs if we're going to be able to do that. You also see in our budget request a request for investment in technology. Minnesota State is the 4th largest higher education system in the country and operates one of the largest single data systems. Ours is a single system, and that's a tremendous advantage to us. Most state systems have multiple technology platforms, multiple products, and very little success with those products cooperating with each other. We've been watching the other higher education systems and the industry very carefully and have concluded that we are now at the point where the risks of doing nothing and the needs of our students and staff are too great. Today, our platform has 32 integrated modules developed using a combination of 5 programming languages and supports 376,000 students. Our CIO hosted a series of listening sessions across the state. More than 1,000 faculty, staff, and students gave him advice about the way forward. In addition, an electronic survey tool generated 1,300 responses. All of this outreach told us that we need technology that provides strong support for student advising, academic planning, career planning, and student success techniques like online tutoring, and that integrates all components of the current software in order to leverage all the data. And finally, improves our security and firewall capability. We look forward to our time with the House Higher Education and Career Committee next week for a complete presentation. Finally, Mr. Chair, you've asked us to speak to the Composite Financial Index. The CFI is a metric promulgated by accrediting agencies as a tool that enables them to compare their several thousand very diverse institutions across the region. We introduced it to the committee last year, and the chair asked us to provide a brief update this year. It's key to understanding this measure to recognize that it's based on full accrual statements, and most of our conversation here in this body is on a cash basis. So it's different language, different arithmetic, but it is the way the metric was created. You heard from the U, the reference to the change in accounting standards. That also has a consequence for us with the addition to the balance sheet of the impact of unfunded pension liabilities. That was a change that happened across the country, cities, counties, school districts, and governmental bodies. And so that change has been incorporated in the numbers as of fiscal 15. The impact of the new standards resulted in our now reporting a downward adjustment of $474 million in the system's net position, following a $519 million downward adjustment in fiscal 15. This change occurs for several reasons. Most common is differences between the actual and forecast earnings estimate on the pension investment program and changes in life expectancy in the underlying actuarial work. The rating agencies have modified their own analytics as a result of this new standard, and they're, interestingly enough, moving more toward cash measurements because the addition of this liability has rendered most of this information not very useful in the national scene because the numbers just got so big. The impact on Minnesota State was moderated compared to other public systems because so many of our employees are in defined contribution programs. And, of course, defined contribution programs don't have unfunded liabilities. And so that did moderate the impact on our results. Most colleges and universities in fiscal 16, in a full accrual expression, reported operating gains due to this GASB adjustment. If you were to look at their financial statements, it looked like they got better from 15 to 16. But if you take out all of the entries related to the unfunded pension liability, you would see an underlying loss, which is due to the enrollment declines. Campuses have held on to their budget reserves, which is a critical risk management strategy for them, and they're struggling to make continued investments in building improvements and infrastructure. And the struggle has gotten more complicated by the lack of a bonding bill because it's putting pressure on their maintenance budgets. So generally, we would conclude that campuses are struggling to balance their budget as enrollment has declined and tuition revenue has flattened out. I have here, Mr. Chair, for you just summary level numbers on the CFI. We do the numbers for all the campuses, but what I have here for you is the systems number because we are a single reporting entity, so the numbers come off of the systems audited financial statements. The board has been a strong supporter of the CFI reporting discipline and a supporter of our goal of improving college and university overall performance with this number. It has proven to be a very valuable tool for us for tracking financial performance across all the schools and from year to year. It has two measures that are weighted towards the balance sheet and two measures that are weighted toward the income statement. And as you can see above, the system showed improvement overall from 15 to 16. If you look at the first two sets of numbers that don't have the entries related to pensions. That improvement, if we measure it at the school level, though, distributes pretty differently. And I would ask that you note that this slide reads from left to right. So you have fiscal 16 on the left in the blue colors and fiscal 15 to the right in the orange colors. This came out of our financial reporting file, and that's the way they put things together for reasons that have never been adequately explained to me. So just be noted on that. What you see is improvement in the CFI scores from 15 to 16, both at the low end, a little bit in the middle, and then at the high end as well. This is happening for a couple of reasons. Most notably is the way the appropriation was provided from in 16 and 17. The schools, by and large, tried to hang on to balances at the end of 16 because they knew they had their expenses doubling in 17 and no appropriation to cover it. And so that reports out as an addition to fund balance. We would expect this trend to reverse when we go from 16 to 17 because we expect those fund balances to be consumed as campuses balance their 17 budgets. The CFI, of course, varies among the colleges and universities. The trend was positive from 15 to 16, and we expect it to turn the other way from 16 to 17. The system CFI has been relatively flat in the two long-term measures with small increases in the two short-term measures. Campuses are displaying very balanced budgeting, planning, and analysis as they work to juggle a lot of really competing pressures. In fiscal 16, we had four colleges and two universities that reported a CFI below 1.5, which is our flag for financial monitoring. We have six colleges and universities now that have prepared financial plans with us, and we're in quarterly or thereabouts monitoring with them to help them on their remediation plans. We similarly are communicating with campus leadership. We expect in these plans that they set targets for reaching structural balance, that they set targets for their fiscal 17 and 18 budget outlook, that they talk with us about their enrollment strategies, and they do some modeling for what they think these strategies will contribute to improving their CFI. We picked 1.5 as the threshold here because the rating agency gets involved at 1.0. And it's our interest to get ahead of the rating agencies and try to help the campuses improve their outlook before the rating agencies are involved. These are very difficult numbers to move, and they're greatly advantaged by regular capital spending, which has slowed down, as members know, in the last couple of years. A scenario that freezes tuition and provides a low budget target with labor costs that are similar in recent years would be devastating to most of our campuses. We have shared with you, I believe last spring, the long-term financial sustainability outlook of our colleges and universities, and flat or declining revenue in the face of increasing costs continues to put tremendous financial pressure on our campuses. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that brings me to the end of the topics you asked me to address, so I will sit back for questions.
Well, thank you, Vice Chancellor King. Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chancellor King, can you illustrate for us how the lack of a bonding bill impacts budget reserves at the campus level?
Vice Chancellor King.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, and I don't know, I can't remember where this happened, but there was just testimony last week about the pressure on campus operating budgets to use reserves to repair things that would ordinarily have been a HEPA-funded item. And I don't have that testimony here in front of me, but I can get it for you.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Mr. Chair, Vice Chancellor King, I appreciate that. And the Higher Education Asset Preservation Fund that wasn't passed because there was no bonding bill, this includes roofs. It would include heating and ventilating systems. It would include any type of a structural problem that happened on campus. And some of these are significant. Usually a leaky roof starts at a million and then climbs, and it doesn't really depend on the building anymore. So the lack of a bonding bill really is an impediment. And my follow-up question is this. If the reserves are used for these things, then what isn't available for something else on campus? What would the reserve be used if it wasn't, it went to a leaky roof? What could it have been used for if it wasn't repairing the roof?
Vice Chancellor King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, the reserves generally should have no purpose. By policy, they're intended to be available for unexpected things. So if a president has an innovation or a new piece of equipment or an initiative they want to undertake, they generally roll that into their operating budget as part of their regular program. So the reserves are there when something unexpected happens. In this case, if the roof fails and the university or the campus college has to turn to reserves, that's exactly what they're there for. But then they have to put money back in their budget to restore the reserves.
Representative Paul.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chancellor King, could the reserves be used for declining enrollments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, one of the programs we have worked on with several colleges and universities is a strategy to reach a balanced budget in a year or two with enrollment growth strategies and using reserves or fund balance in the interim to avoid having to make cuts. That is a short-term strategy, but it is one of the techniques that we have worked with the campuses to enable them to get initiatives underway. Enrollment doesn't show up 2 weeks after the initiative starts. It takes several months to get programs up. And if we're persuaded and the president is persuaded that the investment will pay off, then reserves are available.
Mr. Chair, I use the example of the declining enrollment because we are getting reports of declining enrollment and the impacts of that declining enrollment at campuses.
That's right.
And some of these are significant declines, things we haven't seen previously. It may be an impact, too, by neighboring states and adjustments neighboring states have made in enrollment and opening up their campuses, which are draining students from Minnesota. But, Mr. Chair, there are issues here that are tied to a bonding bill, and there are issues that are tied to a reserve, and certainly tuition and debt are the overriding issues that seem to be the problem that are plaguing all of higher ed. So I appreciate the presentation, Vice Chancellor King. This is a much improved presentation than the one in higher ed.
Vice Chancellor King, first of all, thank you for this very thorough data book. I will certainly be able to spend a lot of time on that. I know there's a couple of other people that want to ask questions, but I did want to ask about this CFI chart where you talked about the whole system with GASB being at 0.79 in 15 going up to 1.5 this year. But you said that was kind of partly because of the flat appropriation from the state of $50 million. So can you predict where it will be in 17? I mean, is it going to drop down to 0.79? Let's say, assuming that it was at $50 million again, I mean, and without getting into talking about, you know, what additional monies you'll get in a target, I mean, what do you anticipate FY17 being this year? I mean, is it going to go back down to 0.79, would you say, all things being equal or better than that?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to need to think about that question a little bit, and I will. But I haven't tried to run scenarios on what I think 17 is going to look like. It's got this, of course, is a sum of all of our parts. And so let me give that a little thought. It is the case in 17 that campuses are using fund balance as part of their budget strategy, so that would be a negative to this arithmetic. It's the case in 17 that we continue not having capital appropriations, which contribute to this. So that's a negative down on that. But there are a couple other things happening. So let me give that a little thought. I wouldn't want to guess, but I'm expecting it to go down, but let me do a little math.
Okay, yeah, I'd appreciate it asking that, because I guess when you think about it, I mean, actually for 17, it doesn't matter what we appropriate for a target this year, because, of course, we'd be appropriate for 18,
that's
19.
Right.
So you've got the $50 million we appropriated last biennium coming for 17, the same amount as you got in 16, which perhaps improved it some. But anyway, I'd appreciate your estimate on that.
Chair, the $50 million in 16 probably improved 16's number, but in 17 we expect campuses to spend part of that because they saved it in 16 to have it in 17.
Right.
So that'll drop this number down.
Right. Okay. So, Representative Houston and Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment to the system. I think they deserve some credit for being extremely responsive to the needs in the workforce and have made the kind of programmatic changes, phasing out or mm-hmm. or adding programs that, in fact, train the workforce that a particular community needs and working with local businesses to accomplish that. And as I poured over the page where you show the enrollment on each campus that's in here, I know Minsk, you tried at one point to either merge or close a campus, and we didn't let you. But as I look at this again, you know, that I think to myself, there must be some people internally who are raising that question about a campus or two, given what's happening. But generally, I think the system has been amazingly responsive to workforce needs and training for that. But, Mr. Chair, my question, I guess, caution is to you, following up on Representative Pawlowski's issue about the bonding delay. And the question you'll have to ask as Chair of Ways and Means is, as you give your response to each bill, where does the first dollar go and why? So we fast-tracked Rural Finance Authority because they're out of money. We're fast-tracking road wetland replacement because they're out of money. I read in the paper that Lewis and Clark is going to come with a standalone bill for $8 million in cash because they don't want to lose the 2017 construction season. And everybody makes sound arguments. But as we heard from Representative Pawlowski's question, that same thing is true of so many other parts. And I guess, you know, to all members here, I'm hoping we're all not taking as the absolutely only way we can do this that bonding has to wait till the last possible minute, and then we risk not having a bonding bill for the third year. So that's observation for the Ways and Means Chair, I think, in terms of as you make your decision as bills come your way.
Well, of course, we did have a bonding bill in 2015. But Representative Carlson.
Yeah, I'm looking at the clock, so maybe this could be done quickly. But, Dr. King, as you know, you and I and a previous chancellor have gone around some time on the reserve question. And if you could, and it would be what the purpose was, and if you could refresh the committee very quickly, the difference between policies that might impact on the central reserve versus the campus reserves, and maybe share with us, it might be in the books, but I didn't get a chance to look at it, what the central reserve is.
Vice Chancellor King.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson, by board policy, campuses are expected to have between 5% and 7% of operating revenues in the bank as a reserve. And that is, by some measures, 50 to 100% less than good financial management advice would suggest. Rating agencies, for instance, would look for something more like 25 to 30%. But board policy is 5 to 7 and has been for many, many years. Board policy further provides that the system have between 1 and 2% of between 1 and 2% of total system revenues as system reserves, and has some language around what those reserves are for and why they're held. The system reserves have been used in the past for things like the fire in Marshall, when the Southwest Student Center burned to the ground. The system reserves were available to help bridge the insurance proceeds. System reserves were used when Fond du Lac lost their BIA relationship very suddenly and had $1 million catastrophe in their operating budget. So system reserves were used for that. Like the campus, system reserves are available for things that nobody saw coming. Campus reserves are supposed to be specifically designated on campus as not intended to do anything but be there until the next emergency happens. And that's in board policy, and it's the way they're administered.
Mr. Chairman, this is the first time that I can recall I've ever heard a number like 25 to 30%. Is that are we talking more when you use that number, cash flow? Because I know your income comes in with tuition, for example, right, and other services in an uneven way. But generally, and I was on with former Governor Carlson, a Blue Ribbon Commission dealing with reserves for the U of M. And what we agreed upon with that Blue Ribbon Commission, by the way, the state auditor then, not governor, was 5%. And I know you said generally for the campuses it's 5 to 7, but you said the financial institutions are recommending 25 to 30. Now, when we dealt with the U of M years ago during Ken Keller's administration, the reserves were greatly misunderstood because the tuition would come in at the beginning,
right,
and then that would be spent down. And at that point, there was a very high percentage, but by the end of a semester, then they would be down to, I would assume, roughly their 5% normal reserve. But I'm separating here reserve and cash flow when you use the number 25 to 30, but I'm looking at the clock and maybe just a quick response, and because I know all of us have to be across the street.
It does seem like a lot, but Vice Chancellor King.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, and Representative Carlson, I meant reserves. And it's from a credit analysis, from a credit analytical standpoint, the rating agencies recognize that we are organizations that are highly enrollment dependent and highly subject to sudden turns in enrollment. And on the other hand, we have very sticky expenses. We're 97% unionized. And so our ability to influence our expenses at the same rate that our revenue is influenced is limited. And so I'm at 25 to 30%.
Mr. Chairman, just very quickly, I think that's something that maybe I can explore a bit more offline because that is a brand new number from my perspective. Maybe it is not for others, but it is for me.
I'd appreciate you doing that, Representative Carlson. I know we've got session at 12:15. I've got one last question I'd like to ask, and then we'll have to adjourn, and that is, Vice Chancellor King, the system's request of $178 million, $143 million of that was campus support, and as I understand it, if you got the full $178 million request, you were committing that there'd be no tuition increase either of the 2 years. Now, the governor, if I recall correctly, had in the campus support area, $125 million recommendation. Can you tell us if we, say, adopted the governor's proposal, what sort of a tuition increase would the system then be planning on putting through?
Mr. Chair, I can't say I'm surprised by the question. That's not the case. The board's position is a $178 million request. And in exchange for that, they pledged to hold undergraduate tuition rates at zero compared to 17. Now, let's remind ourselves...
At zero for 2 years.
For 2 years, that's correct. And let's remind ourselves that college tuition hasn't gone up at all since fiscal 14. In fact, it went down 1% in fiscal 16. University tuition's gone up once in those 4 years. So with your help, we've been making really good progress on tuition. At the governor's recommendation, I would not be in a position to tell you what the board would do today because it's not just the campus support item, it's also the student initiatives and the technology investment. The governor supported the technology investment, which was terrific because we think it's really critical, and did not support the student success initiative. In our world, tuition is about $8 million a point. So for every 1% increase in tuition, it's about $8 million generally. So if you compare the 125 to the request we had with the governor's recommendation, it's missing about $30 to $40 million. But the board would like to get to the end of the legislative session with a great outcome and not have to raise tuition, but they're also not prepared to make a commitment until the session's over because their commitment to structural budget balancing requires that revenues match expenses one way or the other.
So I guess to paraphrase what you're saying that the governor's recommendation has the system getting $30 to $40 million less than what your request is, and that at least the way you calculate it, each 1% of tuition is worth $8 million per
right.
year.
That's right.
So I guess we get back into the math. And
Mr. Chair, I would urge you not to go there. It's not the board's position that they're going to raise tuition to replace every dollar that's not in the request. It's only their position that they will consult with everybody in our community at the end of the session and then make a decision about tuition. We would have to raise tuition 6% a year, year over year, to fund the total of our request. And the board has never indicated any interest in doing that.
Okay, and I guess I was just, and I understand that there are other factors involved here, but I just wanted to get a sense of
yep.
how it affected you. So, well, with that, thank you, Vice Chancellor King,
thank
Mr. Schoenecker. Members were adjourned. Meeting on Wednesday.